So Alvin Wang Graylin thinks the U.S. and China should be cooperating on AI a lot more than they are. What is the likelihood of that? And is AI competition really just an American thing? I decided to follow up on my conversation with Alvin by talking to NPR's John Ruwitch. John, you were based in China for years. You covered politics and tech there, among many things. And now you're back in the U.S. covering politics and tech from Silicon Valley. So give us your perspective on this AI arms race. Is it mostly a story that American tech CEOs are telling to lock down their tech, to get more investment, avoid regulation, as Alvin explains it?
Yeah. From my perspective, like, yes, to a certain extent, but, right, yes, that's capitalism. The corporate competition is real, absolutely. But there is definitely more to this arms race mentality, I think, than just business. A few months ago, I had a conversation with a venture capitalist, and you know, he was telling me that there had been this debate and discussion around the safety of AI, and that companies in the United States had potentially discussed banding together, maybe sort of hitting pause on sort of the breakneck speed at which everybody was racing towards AGI, if that's where they were headed, to sort of set some rules. But then DeepSeek R1 happened. That was the release in January of a Chinese AI model. And it was kind of a Sputnik moment. Like, DeepSeek did things that people did not think China was capable of doing because of the restrictions on high-end microchips going to China. They did things, but they kind of circumvented the embargo on chips to put forward an AI model, an AI product that was pretty darn good and pretty close to what American companies were doing. So the discussion shifted to national security. Everybody was like, okay, China's for real, and we need to go at it again.
So tell us more about China's approach to AI, because I think in the U.S., AI is mostly making people kind of nervous for all sorts of reasons, their jobs, the amount of energy it uses, the slop it can produce. But what have you learned about how regular people feel about AI there?
Yeah. So in China, the government is obviously very focused and strategic in its thinking about AI. And I went on a trip to China in October and did some reporting around AI in society, basically. And one of the places we went was an elementary school in Beijing. And at this elementary school, and in fact, at all K-12 schools in Beijing starting this fall semester, they started to fold education about AI and education on sort of how AI is created and how you can use it into the computer literacy programs that they run. So we went and we talked to a couple of 10-year-olds, fourth graders, talked to their parents, talked to the teacher about what this AI education was like. And as you can imagine, like, it's not in-depth, but they are being consciously and proactively familiarized with artificial intelligence, with how to use it. They're using it to do drawings, to do images, for instance. The parents were very clear-eyed about the project, which I thought was interesting. They basically were all sort of all in on it because they see it as, you know, it is this technology that's coming down the pike. The government backs it. It's coming for us. And there's the only way for our kids to have a future is to start to understand it.
So we have the Trump administration with its American AI Action Plan, focusing on maintaining America's dominance, countering China. And then a couple years ago, President Xi released his Global AI Governance Initiative, and it's completely different. It's an open source, sharing AI models, data, security, bridging the digital divide. What's your sense about how politics and interests are fueling these different approaches, and are they sort of veering away from each other or coming to a head?
Context is sort of key here for China. There's been this program, it's sort of part of the party's DNA now, to build influence and clout around the world, make the world safe for, you know, the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese way of, you know, politics. And I think the Global AI Governance Initiative at least has two sides to it. One is the altruistic part, right? Let's work on this together. Let's do it together. It's also sort of a textbook example of how China operates, how China it builds power and helps itself in the world.
just sort of like, look at us, we're available. What's the big fuss about? That
exactly,
kind of thing.
Exactly, right. Look, we're being big about this. We're trying to fix the problem. We're trying to get everybody together. Let's all work together. And it's easier for an underdog to say that than somebody who's got the top AI companies, right? And as an underdog, why not, try to get as much cooperation and collaboration as you can, because that can advance your own technology, right? It's very practical for China, which doesn't have the data centers or the compute firepower that the U.S. has, right? It can help accelerate development even. It's also practical for what we were just talking about, China, in terms of, garnering friends and allies and building influence.
In a minute, more with John Ruich on what all this AI competition really means for the rest of us. On the show today, who is shaping the future of AI? I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. We'll be right back. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. On the show today, we are asking, who is really shaping the future of AI? We were just talking to NPR tech correspondent John Ruich about the latest twists in U.S.-China tech relations, including the Trump administration's recent move to let NVIDIA sell advanced AI chips to China. So what does a move like this actually signal? A thaw? A strategic gesture? Or something more complicated?
I mean, from people I've talked to, from a technical perspective, are scratching their heads, like chip experts or China experts. They're saying, this is the one, sort of perhaps the one advantage that we have over China. Like, China has more and cheaper electricity than we have, which is critical for data centers. China, I read a stat the other day that said over 40% of Chinese college graduates are in STEM. That's twice the rate in the United States, right? So, they've got the people, they've got the electricity, they've got the political will for sure. They can't get their hands on the chips, and now they're sending these chips over. One guy I spoke with said it's almost the equivalent of folks who were working on the Manhattan Project to develop the first nuclear bomb just handing blueprints over.
You did just get back from Taiwan, where the factories are that produce 90% of the world's semiconductor chips, the ones that are needed to power AI. Can you just tell us about what you saw there?
Yeah, I was in China for about 2 weeks. On the way out, I stopped in Taiwan and took a train down to a town called Hsinchu, which is on the west coast. It's like 100 miles due east of the Chinese coast. And I went to visit TSMC. There's a science park there where Taiwan's semiconductor manufacturing company, TSMC, was established in 1987. So over the past 40 years, this company has become the dominant player in contract chip manufacturing. And they're in everything. They're in your iPhone, they're in your car, they're in satellites, they're in F-35 fighter jets, on and on and on. And I talked to the CFO who it was really interesting. Like, the politics around microchips, the politics of Taiwan, China was kind of a black hole. Every time I raised it, he avoided answering it, and he would talk about the customers and what the customers want. And the interesting thing about that is that the customers are being pushed very strongly by political winds. And that's the reason why in 2020, TSMC decided they would set up a chip-making facility in Arizona. They've got plans to expand their operations in Japan, Germany also for the auto industry. And he basically said he didn't say it in so many words, but he said they're outgrowing Taiwan.
So I was at a conference a couple months ago where it was off the record, and many economists and former government officials were warning, like, Taiwan is the reason the U.S. and China will inevitably go to war. So based on what you're saying, is that overblown? Because it sounds like chip production is going to be spread well beyond Taiwan.
Yeah, that's a good point. Chip production is now, they're expanding beyond Taiwan. I will say TSMC's CFO told me they will continue to invest in Taiwan. But I do think it's fair to say that Taiwan is probably the most likely reason that China and the U.S. would have a fight. I mean, the South China Sea might be another possibility if there were some sort of, accident to happen that spiraled out of control. But the most sort of dire consequences would come from war over Taiwan. I mean, Beijing considers it part of China, as you know. The U.S. Government is bound by law to help Taiwan arm itself, to prepare it, to deter and repel a Chinese invasion, basically. And the U.S. has had a policy of strategic ambiguity when it comes to Taiwan. It's a tenuous situation, but it has been for 80 years, right?
So that brings us back to Alvin Graylin. I mean, when I talk to him, you know, in some ways, I'm like, oh, this China-U.S. thing, it's not so intense. And then you hear him describe the Mad Max future, and you think, this is a disaster. I don't even know what to make of it.
Well, there's a couple of thoughts I have. One is I'm glad he's out there saying these things, because if there's a way to find some sort of middle ground, some small like academic committee that can then grow over time or expand to include government and then be a way for Beijing and Washington to talk about this stuff, maybe start to think about moving forward in ways that they can cooperate, great. But the other thought I had was that he seems to be a product of Silicon Valley. And this is the place where people, you know, come up with audacious ideas and pitch them, and they're pretty good at pitching them. Like, it's kind of, I don't know what would ever, I don't, at this point, I don't see what would push the US and China to cooperate on AI or to talk about cooperating on AI without a crisis or a near crisis.
You know, it makes me want to ask, are we missing a trick? In the United States, tech companies are so focused on getting consumers to buy subscriptions to these products, and they're being so protective of their tech. Meanwhile, many people are terrified that they're going to lose their jobs because AI will replace them. But then there's China trying to diffuse AI throughout their whole society and make it available open source to other countries. They seem to have a more practical and strategic rollout in some ways.
I think each country has its advantages, right? I think one thing about the U.S. system is that Wild West mentality sort of applies. It's like, this is the cutting edge of capitalism. This is hardcore capitalism. There are winners and there are losers. And I think that there are reasons why China does it the Chinese way. We don't know what's going to happen with AI yet, but they've done a lot to make life more comfortable in, for instance, their cities or across the country. It also fits into sort of that broader context of China building influence, building clout, making itself indispensable in the world. If it's the one driving this plan, if it's the one that can get buy-in from its the ally countries that it works with, that perhaps are, you know, more open to using open source, or for whom closed source is too expensive, right?
I've got sort of a hot take, which is, you know, American, well, Chinese society locked down, but open source software, whereas in the U.S., it's the other way around. They're locking down their tech, but it's sort of open source humans. Do you know what I mean? Mm. They kind of like let us loose and help let us figure it out. And then wherever the marketplace takes us, well, that's where we go, for better or worse.
Yeah, that works. The open source thing about Chinese tech, though, it's open source for the code and for to figure out how to do it. But you can't, like, if you're in China, you can't ask DeepSeek, hey, tell me about what happened on June 4th, 1989 in Tiananmen Square, and get a straight answer.
Right, right.
And that is, you know, open to a degree, and then not open. And believe me, I think if China had this technology locked down and the U.S. was following, I don't think they'd be open source with it.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying watch this space. We might be seeing a lockdown on these models in the future if they catch up?
Maybe. Yeah, if they can't, if they catch up, if they surpass, if they've got something off the wall, perhaps. The DeepSeek guys, DeepSeek is a private company. I guess they got some, I'm not exactly sure where they got their funding, but you know, after the model came out in January and blew everybody's minds, they were not available. You could not talk to them. You could not get anywhere near them. Was that because the cyberspace administration said to them, yeah, we need to talk, or you should not talk to the press, or were these guys just savvy? We don't know.
2026, John. I'm excited.
Pumped. Getting fired up for it.
Excellent. I mean, the saga is just going to get more interesting.
Yeah.
Let's hope it doesn't veer into those terrifying territories just yet.
Let's cross our fingers.
That was John Ruich. He's NPR's tech correspondent, and he is based in San Francisco.